from the heart of the Forest City, this is the Craig Needles Podcast, brought to you by Lexus of London. Now here's your host, Craig Needles.
The Craig Needles Podcast and the Friday Roundtable here on a Remembrance Day Friday, and we appreciate you downloading on ClassicRock981.com, LondonNewsToday.ca, and wherever you get your podcasts. Of course, the Craig Needles Podcast is brought to you by our friends over at Lexus of London. And to chat with us here on the Friday Roundtable today, we are joined by Kelly Elliott, the Deputy Mayor of Thames Centre, former City Councillor Hollywood Cheryl Miller, and City Councillor Sean Lewis for the City of London. Hello, everybody. Thank you for being here.
Hello.
Got
hello.
Old, medium, and young.
Wait.
I think I'm old.
if someone's old, it's going to have to be you, I'm sorry to say.
That just is so ageism.
So Kelly, I guess, gets to be young.
Yes.
I'm very slightly older than Kelly, so I am qualifying
You're
as
medium.
Young as well.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what's going on in the City of London and elsewhere this week. But first, let's talk about what's going on in the province of Ontario this week. And the biggest story was what is going on at schools all over Ontario. Not everywhere in Ontario. I know that some family of mine in Kitchener-Waterloo didn't have any school disruption, but we sure did here in London, where we missed 2 days because QP was off the job. The government said they were going to use the notwithstanding clause, and then this week said, okay, we're not going to use the notwithstanding clause after all, but you have to come back to work. QP agreed to that. The two sides are currently negotiating. Doug Ford is trying to negotiate in public, and QP has asked him to stop doing that. Did the government lose this one? Was this a loss for them that they used the bluster of the notwithstanding clause again, only to have to, after a weekend to think about it, take it back? Was this a loss for the Ford government, do you think?
Absolutely. And I think today, I mean, they pulled their complaint from the Labor Relations Board in regards to deeming that an unlawful strike. They've kind of backed away and they have nothing to win right now. They've had to pull everything they've done. They've said they're not going to fine workers. They're not going to deem an unlawful strike. They're going to repeal Bill 28. So everything they did to try and get the public to side with them has failed. And so I don't know where they come back to say that they win this.
I don't agree with you at all. Because I don't think they lost. I think they were almost brilliant, because if they hadn't have done that, then the streets would still be full of people marching on the streets, schools would be closed, QP's not back in. They had no bargaining chip. Their bargaining chip was nothing. Their contract was not a good one for them. So the only bargaining chip is, we'll withdraw this legislation if you go back into the classroom. And I think it worked.
But they can still go on strike is the trouble.
Well, of course they can. But the point is, are they? Because right now, do you think public's going to support them because they go on strike because they want 11% increase? I don't think so.
Yeah, I think they might.
I agree with Cheryl on this one in so far as to say I don't think it was a loss.
No.
I don't think either side won in this, but I don't necessarily think that this counts as a government loss. I think what they showed is they're absolutely willing to play hardball and use every tool in the toolbox, even the really unpopular ones. I think the QP preliminary offer of 11% was, you can't expect to catch up. And I know you've said this before, Craig, this didn't start with the Ford government.
No.
They're behind. You can track why they're behind back to Dalton McGuinty. Yeah.
Right.
The Ford government hasn't fixed it, but you can't fix all those years of falling behind in one contract cycle. You've got to be reasonable and willing to step it up one step at a time.
But you ask for it, and then you go, you meet in the middle.
But what's happened is, to Cheryl's point, both sides are now back at the table. And I mean, the mediator's absolutely right to say to the premier, stop negotiating in public. That's not how you negotiate a labor contract. I don't care what level of government you are. I don't care what union you're dealing with. I don't care if you're the private sector. Negotiating good faith at the bargaining table behind closed doors. But it's got both sides back to talking. We've got a second offer that's come forward from QP, which, from what we've read, seems much more reasonable. So I think that I think both sides lost in this. I think both sides lost some public goodwill.
But the kids won.
But the kids are back in class,
right,
and people are back at the bargaining table.
Yep.
So I think in the long run, at worst, it's a draw even sort of scenario.
But the thing is that it should have never gotten to this point. So QB, one, never asked for, so just to clear, it was never an 11% increase. They gave a dollar amount per hour to get them up. And you're right, it's been a decade of where they've fallen behind. And so, and Craig is right that you put everything on the table. That's how union negotiations work. You put everything on the table you're going to ask for and you negotiate. They had to give a 5-day notice for a strike, which is exactly what they did. QP followed the rules, and they never got to the bargaining table because there were 3 days that week set up for bargaining. And before they could do that, Ford threw out Bill 20 and Lecce threw out Bill 28. So they didn't even go to the table that week because Bill 28 came out.
If you want to talk about a loser in this whole scenario, I think the biggest loser is the education minister. Yeah. I think this is the end of Lecce as education minister, and that can't really come soon enough.
I negotiated school board contracts for 12 years, and that's when we sat at the table and we were there day and night. And it was an amazing learning opportunity. But
that's not how it goes anymore, Cheryl.
No. I know. I understand that. But when you say everything's on the table, what do you know? You're asking for an amount of dollars. Nobody is absolutely talking about their benefits. Benefits are huge cost to education. You need to know that. Yeah. What's their benefits? What do they want
the
more?
They are, although I don't think the benefits of these part-time education assistants are getting are anything close to what teachers, for example, are getting in the classroom.
Well, some of them are better.
And there's other details, too, in this. Like in Bill 28, like if you go through the fine print of it all, like Lecce doesn't guarantee ECEs in kindergarten rooms anymore. So there was far more going on than just the 11, or if you want to say 11%, or the wages was just a very big, a little piece in what was happening across the table. And I think that there was a huge undervaluation of what these support workers do in our schools. And I think that wasn't being seen by the province. And that was a stance QP took to show the value that these support workers, whether it's the secretaries, the custodians, the admin, ECEs, EAs, IAs, whatever it was.
Here's what I'll say is, let's use the secretaries as an example. When I go into my daughter's school, they know who I am and who I'm looking for. There are hundreds of kids that go to my daughter's school. But the staff at that office, there's Charlotte's dad. He's here to get Charlotte. The ECEs, like, these people are worth twice what we pay them. They are, without it, my daughter's kindergarten classroom just wouldn't be functional. And I think that we sometimes forget how integral some of these support staffers are to school. And here's the other thing. And I said this on the podcast a couple weeks ago. If we were in a situation where Doug Ford was using the notwithstanding clause against teachers making $80,000-$90,000 a year, public opinion would have been vastly, vastly different on this. Vastly different. ECEs making, half of that, less than half of that. It's a different conversation. So I think that this goes into a loss for them because they were seen as being bullies. If it were a situation where they were going up against teachers, rightly or wrongly, I think a lot of people in the public would see this as two equals butting heads, but they were seen as being bullies because you're going after these people that are on this end of the income scale.
Well, I agree with you there. I think if this was the, ETFO or OSSTF negotiation,
it's a different conversation.
It's a very different conversation. And there's no, I don't think any of us disagree that the EAs and the ECEs bring a tremendous value to the classrooms. It might be, for me or for Cheryl, somebody of the medium to older vintage.
To come back to the start of the show. Right? Good wine.
I went to school in a time where there were no such thing as ECEs in kindergarten classrooms, and they functioned. But I recognize that how schools function today are quite different from how schools functioned many years ago. I also agree with you, Craig, the administration staff. And listen, I don't have a kid in the school system right now, but every secretary in every elementary school in my ward knows me by name when I come in, to whether I'm coming in to see the principal or for home and school association, or like, those are the folks who keep the schools running, no doubt about it. So it is a different conversation with this, but I don't think that this is, and to Kelly's point, Bill 28 was the mistake because of all the other little devils in the detail there. You're right about that, Kelly. For me, though, I think that what you saw was a government that's now positioned themselves as being, okay, well, we'll step back. will be reasonable. We'll come back to the negotiating table if you come back to the classroom. So I think that they've changed the narrative on it in a fairly short order. And I think it was wise of them to do so rather than dig in to trenches and have this prolonged period where kids are out of school, where they're battling the unions, where it's a you know, it's a losing scenario no matter what you do when kids are out of class.
They had no other option.
Yeah,
they what had no was other choice their other yeah. option?
Keep they kids out of class for much longer, and nobody wants that.
Well, the other option was, hey, will you take, you know, $250 an hour raise? That was one of the options. And the thing is, well, we had no other option but this. I suspect that the deal QP winds up getting does not look all that similar to a deal they'd have taken 2 weeks ago. And if that's the case,
that we don't know.
I'm guessing.
You're speculating.
Because QP has a whole lot of leverage now because they know that the government cannot afford them going on strike again. And QP, they probably know they'd take some damage to that, but they think they're now that this whole Bill 28 thing has played out, the stakes are higher for Ford and for Lecce than they are for QP. I think that QP has enough leverage here. They're going to say, no, we're going to, like, you know, instead of putting percent on it, we'll come back for $2 an hour extra every year for the next 4 years.
If QP's smart, they'll do a back end loaded contract.
That's what they should do, and maybe they will. But.
And work up the step ladder to where you want to be over 4 years because, you know, you can't make up 10 years in 1 year. It just is not going to happen. And as a taxpayer, and let me tell you the conversations at our family who are teachers and ECEs, the discussion is always very warm. They can't do it in one more year.
I can't imagine a warm discussion at the mill. I think it's probably more in the supernova category.
I just think that the option that, like, they say, oh, we had no other option but to use Bill 28. The other option was give them a deal that is probably going to look the heck of a lot like the deal they're about to get.
The first week, no, you don't. You don't.
Then
I think the other thing,
give it to them on Thursday night. Then
no.
make them think they're going to strike for the day and sort of see what their resolve is. Like they.
If you don't think they polled and they know exactly where they're going to be.
Oh, I think they polled, and that's why they went and got rid of Bill 28.
Oh, I think they got Bill 28. I don't think they polled. I think everybody's thinking it's disastrous. I don't think so. I think they just think
he
pulled out a club that nobody thought he'd use.
Even if it wound up still being a 2-day strike, if you negotiate through the week and say, hey, look, we had to stick to a hard line here, and they go on strike without using Bill 28, you are in a very different public relations position than the one they found themselves in. A very different public relations position.
There's no friendship between the two of them.
And you can only
negotiate if you've got two sides that are willing to meet.
You know who I think is probably super pissed about this, although he's never going to say it?
Monty McNaughton,
Kelly, thank you.
Yeah.
Because, look, and here, I'm going to give Monty and his team a lot of credit because he's got some pretty sharp people on his team, and I think Monty's a pretty smart guy. When Monty became Minister of Labor, said, we're going to reach out to labor unions. We're not going to be the government that labor unions hate all the time. And Monty, to his credit, got a whole bunch of private sector labor endorsements for the progressive conservative government in the 2022 campaign, which that's good politics, good work.
He didn't get the teachers, and he didn't.
Did, well, yeah, but they were never going to get them.
No, they never.
But you go get LIUNA, you go get. Yep. These are like legitimate unions with large memberships. So you go get them. That's good news. That's what you want to do.
Education is.
But now, and I tweeted this: Doug Ford, and Stephen Lecce have sort of taken a flamethrower to all that work, and Monty hasn't said anything about it, and he never will. Of course, I'm not expecting him to. But if I were in his office today, if I were at the Ministry of Labor office, and you're thinking to yourself, we've spent years on this, and now LIUNA is sending their people to a rally where they're on the stage talking about how draconian we are, like that's an unforced error.
You know, the thing is, though, that you got to keep in mind, and I know that some of the private sector unions were at the press conference and such, but the private and the public sector unions are not singing from the same hymn book on every play.
I agree.
It's just not the way
it is. And we saw that in the 2022 campaign.
We absolutely did. And I don't think that this radically undermines the work Monty has done, although certainly it doesn't help.
It's not good.
It doesn't help, but I think I agree that Monty's done some really solid work in terms of developing some better relationships.
It's all about that building relationships, and this didn't help to build bridges.
I think it hurt Lecce more than anybody. And yeah. I think it's time for Lecce to sort of see the door. And I also feel the very same thing about the director here in London. So, you know, I think there's a couple of doors.
I'll join that club.
A couple of doors that need to be opened that these two gentlemen walk out of.
Yeah.
There were a couple of those doors should have been opened before the provincial election.
Absolutely.
So.
Lecce was put in there as a negotiations guy. Mm. And the negotiations haven't gone well. So you would think at some point there's going to be a shuffle of some kind where he's out of education. I would suspect.
Teachers don't love suspect. Him. They don't love
you know, now that you mention it, yeah.
You know, the whole question, though, does raise, and I know the teachers union and the QP are going to hate hearing me say this, but it does raise the question about, do we need to consider the education sector as an essential service?
Ooh.
If I were a teacher
and if I were a QP worker, I would say yes, sign me up for that. If do you want to do as well as the firefighters and police have done the last 20 years? Because they've done pretty well. If I were QP, I would have the right to strike.
So it has to go to an arbitrator.
Right.
There's a disagreement.
If I were a binding arbitrator.
Yes. Yeah.
And if binding. I were in QP, if I were in ETFO or OSSTF, whichever one, I would sign up for that in 2 seconds. Oh, are we going to go on the same wage increase pattern that police officers and firefighters have gone on the last 20 years? Sign me up for that tomorrow is what I would say.
It's not that easy, though.
Because I know it's not that easy, but that's but if we're going to declare someone an essential service, and hey, maybe we do declare education an essential service. I don't know. But I just don't see how that's necessarily a move that's bad news for the workers within those unions because, again, like... how about the London Police Association? And they've done pretty good. I'm not saying they shouldn't but they've done quite well.
And I think a lot of parents would look at education and say, yeah, that's pretty friggin' essential to my kids' well-being. And to your point, I think there are members of those unions who would say, yeah, we are essential. We shouldn't. Mm-hmm. We should have binding arbitration. That'd be a better deal. But we've had so many disruptions to the classroom over the last 4 years that I really think it's time we have a mature discussion about whether or not we view education like we view healthcare, like we view police services as an essential part of our social services.
It's a numbers game. When you look at the police and you look at the firefighters and you look at the numbers of teachers and QP's 55,000, so I don't know how many teachers, which are significant. It's a numbers game. And that's how it's going to always play out. Less numbers, you can have binding arbitration. Lots of people, it's never going to be there. Too expensive.
Well, you know what else is expensive? Disrupting kids' education all the
time. Got it. We did it. Pandemic did it. I mean, going on and on, these kids.
Let's quickly switch gears here. But before we do that, I do want to mention that the Craig Needles podcast is brought to you by our friends over at Lexus of London. Lifestyle with the drive. Your new Lexus is patiently waiting at the award-winning Lexus of London. It's luxury redefined. You can find them at 1065 Warncliffe Road South and online at lexusoflondon.com. The casino here in London. We were going to go out to Wonderland Road. Instead, we're staying at Western Fairs. Is it good news? Is it bad news? Is it neither? I saw some of the reaction online was, why do we need a casino at all? I don't think should London have a casino, yes or no, is the question anymore. That question has been answered, and you don't have to like the answer to the question, but the question is answered. Yeah. So if we're going to have one, do you want it at Western Fair or do you want it at Wonderland Road? What are your thoughts, Sean?
You like it? Absolutely. Very, 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 very happy that this is going to stay at Western Fair and the enhancements are going to happen there. This is a fit with the idea of making the core and the Western Fair District an entertainment district. You look at all the work that has gone into 100 Kellogg Lane and revitalizing that area. We just approved planning applications for the rebuild of the old McCormick's factory property. You've got Hard Rock Cafe looking to build a hotel by 100 Kellogg. This is where we want the action to be.
Yep.
And this is exactly where, and I'm with you. You know what? I'm not having a conversation about whether or not we have a casino. We have one. It's staying. This is where it should stay.
I lost that vote years ago. Have I been in there to gamble? No, I didn't. Haven't. But is it good at Western Fair? Absolutely. And it brings in a check to the city. It brings in a check to Western Fair. You see the growth and the change at the fair. So it's absolutely a tourist attraction down there. It's great for Old East. Actually, Old East is putting downtown London at shame. They are doing so many amazing things down there. And I look at downtown London, I think, hey, guys, go talk to East London.
I should call Gord Hume about the casino conversation. I thought, if I recall correctly, you two would have had each other pretty good over that one.
We did.
Yeah.
I'll maybe just add another perspective to this that sure. never actually got discussed during it, but the horse racing portion of yes. the casino. So right. Moving to Wellington would have been disastrous for Standard Bred Canada and the racing industry, just because London is a key spot for the horse racing industry and for Standard Bred Canada. I know the provincial government has been pumping money into the smaller facilities like Hanover and Clinton, but London is where the horse racers want to be, and so moving that to Wellington would have absolutely killed that industry there, because that was going to that portion was going to stay at Western Fair while the rest of the casino moved to Wellington. So keeping it there will keep the horse racing in Standard Bred Canada going.
Win-win-win, it's Wonderland.
It yeah. makes the use of the raceway for concerts more yeah. viable. Yeah. It makes the hosting. Listen, I know when there are hockey tournaments hosted at the Western Fair ice rinks on weekends, there are parents who go over to the casino. Well, they've got to stand around for an hour mm-hmm. while the kids are in the dressing room with coaches getting ready for the game, and they don't have anything else to do. So it is a draw for visitors from out of town to have an opportunity to go to the casino while they're in that district doing something else anyway.
And there's more games coming, and they're also bringing food. Yep. So there's mm-hmm. they're gonna upscale it, and I think we deserve upscaled in East London.
The original version of this plan that was going to happen at the State at Western Fair in 2018, they said there'd be 1,000 new employees. I don't know if it's going to be that many, but there'll be people who are working there, which is good. Something that someone brought up on Twitter, and shout out to AJ Ray for this, and I like AJ a lot. He brought up, what if instead of that happening at Western Fair, we could have just gone to Wonderland Road anyway, which is close to the 401, and then all that land at Western Fair, all of a sudden that can be some prime spot for developing some pretty intense, very close to the core housing.
Okay.
Sean, was there anything to do that to that in your opinion, or do you think that would be workable or a worthwhile conversation?
No, look, there's lots of land already in that the sort of core area district, and I talked about the McCormick's property.
Yep.
Not every vacant piece of property is going to be redeveloped for housing, despite the fact that we do need lots of housing density and intensification. You know, I would point out just a couple blocks away, another high density residential unit was appealed.
Yeah. yep.
By a group that Unity. Advocates housing. For affordable housing.
That was inexplicable, that appeal. That was almost
fundraising
to
pay for our lawyer.
But the other thing is, there are pieces of the Western Fair land, and I'm not going to get into great detail about this, but definitely. There are pieces that are not available for development.
Right.
If we take up the parking lot, there's going to be problems underneath. Housing's not going there.
Right.
And like I said, I'm not going to get into the details of that. I will just leave it at, there are parts of that land that are not redevelopable.
Right. And
they're not going to be housing.
It's owned by city, and on top of it is the Western Fair. You build housing there, you're going to lose your fair license, because it's important that you have an annual fair. There's all kinds of complications. It's not, oh, we got the land, we'll build on it.
And by the way, some of the money from the Western Fair or from the casino that comes in goes towards addiction treatment services in this city. And so we lose that too. So,
and that's the one spot in the debate I don't have a lot of time for is, oh, we should just not have gambling in the city of London. Guess what? I'm holding a cell phone in my hand right now, dear listener. I could play blackjack. I could play roulette. I can bet on basically any sporting event in the world from this cell phone.
Hell,
there's going to be gambling.
God, there's gambling walking across the streets in London. Jeez,
I can't get through the first period of a Leafs game without seeing like 16 television.
Yeah, I've got Jesse Pinkman telling me that I need to buy whatever. I'm not even going to say the company, but you know,
putting
it
out by the 401 is, you know, at the end of the day, that to me is much more sprawl, because now you're telling people they've got to drive there. That's their only option.
Yeah.
If you put it out by the 401.
No, this is a
and there's
one.
Like there is, as you pointed out, some really good entertainment stuff happening in that section of the city right now. So we've got hockey out there. We've got the Factory, 100 Kellogg Lane, Hard Rock Cafe coming in.
The Children's
in.
Museum is heading out there.
Children's Museum is heading there, which a little bit to my chagrin, but that's a personal problem. it's close to where I live now.
Listen, eventually there'll be an East London link that you and Charlotte and Peyton can take the bus out to the Children's Museum.
I'm looking forward to that day. But there's good reason to say, hey, this is an entertainment spot in the city.
Yep. So that was Joe Fontana. I'm going to remind people that was his vision with the
100 Kellogg.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but we're not building the gondolas to get people out there.
No, the gondolas were downtown. You forgot.
Well, there's a bit of a gondola network. Last thing before we wrap up the podcast here, I want to talk about what the City of London has said for their homelessness plan. And you can see the story at londonnewstoday.ca right now. Multi-agency $5 million expanded services to help support London's homeless this winter. Is this going to be an effective plan in your estimation, Cheryl? Have you looked too much into it? Do you think that there is something to this? Are we doing the right things, the wrong things with this?
No, it's not going to work. If you look at the numbers, how they flesh out, it's 10 one place, 50 at another. It's not enough. This isn't the answer at all. So I don't know. And the money's been spent or committed without going to council. And I think that's unfortunate, because sometimes when you start doing those little things like that, then what it does, it bites council in the ass, because they're the ones that'll wear it when it doesn't work.
So Sean? I will say this.
Do you feel like you've been bitten in the ass?
No.
Not yet, but I will be before I leave here.
Normally, would this come to council for approval first? Yes. However, we have been in restricted acts of council in a lame duck status since August. So this was a delegated authority to our staff. They have put it together.
Still don't agree.
I think that they've done the best they can with what they've got right now? Yes. Is this the solution? No. Now, I will disagree with Cheryl in that I think part of the solution is 10 here, 20 there, 15 there. I don't think 500 in one spot is the right answer.
No, I'm not saying that.
But I will also say that this is another Band-Aid, because until the province of Ontario pulls its head out of its backside and gets serious about creating more mental health and addiction treatment beds to replace the 750 they closed at the London Psychiatric Hospital, we are never going to solve this problem.
And one thing that I want to point out, and I've been very vocal about this isn't a City of London problem.
No.
This is a Southwestern Ontario problem. Regional. And the fact it's a regional problem, and everybody needs to be at the table to address this. And it comes down
including
to...
including the municipalities who are putting people on buses and sending them here for service.
Yeah.
But I am tired of hearing from people that I've stopped to talk to on Dundas Place or another, because I spend half the week downtown. I'm tired of hearing... when I do chat with them, and Mel Sheehan, who's been on this program, has introduced me to a couple people. And when the conversation turns to, where have you come from? Windsor, Toronto, Windsor,
Sarnia.
I'm tired of hearing that. We don't have the services for the people who are already here, and other municipalities have to stop doing that. Or send us the funding that they're getting from the province.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That they're supposed to be using for social services in their community. Sorry, Kelly.
Rural and small municipalities here who don't get that funding, who the province won't recognize that homelessness and addictions happen in rural and small communities as well, and force them into our larger urban centers that can't handle it. And it goes for London, Stratford, all of those places where people get forced into, who then they can't cope, who then send them to a bigger center where they can't cope. It's a regional problem.
And to be clear, this is not about the small communities that don't have services available. And you know, I grew up in a small town in Wallaceburg, so I get it. Not every community has services available.
But it's about working together.
It's not about those communities not having the service. I mean, ideally, the services would be there as well. But I recognize in some of those communities, the services simply don't exist. But you can't tell me the services don't exist in Windsor. The services don't exist in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And these are big urban municipalities in some cases that are sending their homeless to London. And it's got to flip and stop. And I don't want to hear how it's hearsay, because I've heard it from the lips of people who are sitting in Victoria Park right now, or who are sitting on Dundas Place, because I've had people who are homeless introduce me to other people and they've told me directly. So it's not hearsay, it is happening. To what scale? I can't say.
Talk to
but it's
police.
Happening and it's got
to
stop.
Talk to the police. The other thing is $5 million equals 190 spots for care? That to me, that the math doesn't work there. That's a significant amount of dollars. That's because we're going to be renting hotel rooms. You're going to be sending them to places right now.
No, this,
who do
this
not,
model does not include hotel rooms.
Well, then Unity can't take any
but,
more in. They Unity has not got anybody down there. They're all
but are these
hotels.
More expensive than a bed than a rent? Yes, they are.
Yeah,
because these are not folks who can manage their daily lives on their own. They it's need not. Supported. And staff have to be paid. You know, we were talking about the QP workers earlier in the program, and the same goes for the frontline social services workers who are providing those frontline supports. They need to get paid too, and a lot of them are underpaid. These are organizations that are often working on a shoestring budget. So there are higher costs to supporting these people than just simply a roof over their head.
And I'm disagreeing because there is no wraparound service involved with that. You put people in a motel, and you give them opportunities for food. There's no counseling. There's no wraparound service. Until we adopt as a community that if we're going to house them, we're going to wraparound service and get them in.
Now, I'm
going to
disagree with you partly there because at LOSA and the service that they provided last winter, and I saw it for myself, I went out and...
That's one organization. I agree.
They are providing. Now, is it a full 100% wraparound service? No. But it is not just sticking them in a room and leaving them to their own devices. They are providing counseling. They are providing culturally appropriate supports. They are doing those things. Could they be doing more? Yes, but they need the resources and funding to do it. But they are providing supports.
$5 million.
I wish that we could talk about this more, but we're up against the clock and we got to get out of the studio. So thank you very much to Kelly and to Cheryl and for Sean for doing the show with us this week. And thanks very much to Lexus of London, Lifestyle with the Drive. Your new Lexus is patiently waiting at the award-winning at Lexus of London, 1065 Warncliffe Road South, and online at lexusoflondon.com.
The Craig Needles Podcast is a presentation of the Blackburn Media Podcast Network.